Vodka O'Clock.
Good evening, everyone. It's Vodka O'Clock, and I'm Amber Love of AmberUnmasked.com. Just a reminder, we are labeled as an explicit podcast and website. So joining me today is Bryn Pryor to talk about his new independent movie, Cowboys and Engines, which is a steampunk western right up my alley, feature film currently being funded through a Kickstarter campaign. So the film stars, all my nerds out there know, Walter Koenig, and whose name I probably didn't even pronounce right, and Jeff Cannata, I guess, is somebody I probably should know, but I don't. I will confess. So, Bryn, welcome to Vodka O'Clock.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So, yes, a steampunk western.
A steampunk western.
So I read a lot of comics in this type of genre. I was really excited about this. Plus, I read classics. I mean, Lone Ranger is my favorite comic. So.
Wow. Okay.
I know. They're still making it, and it's better than ever. So.
Yeah, you can't possibly be excited about the new movie.
No, I'm not at all.
Okay, good.
The fact that The Lone Ranger is not a steampunk western and is a straight-up spaghetti western type thing, then, you know, it's like those two don't mix.
No, not at all. And also just looks horrible on top of
it. Yeah, it really does.
Yeah.
So other than steampunk western, what can you give me the rundown of the plot and the story of what Cowboys and Engines is?
The story is it follows primarily two characters. Cade Ballard is our male lead. Cade, played by Jeff Cannata, who I'm not surprised that you haven't run into him. I really think it's a weird gender thing. He was on an incredibly popular geek podcast that he started with his friends called The Totally Rad Show, and does a number of things now, like Weekend Confirmed and Always On. But primarily, the only people I meet who really know Jeff's stuff are dudes. I don't know why that is. And then, of course, Walter Koenig, everybody knows in some form or another, whether it's Babylon 5 or whether it's Star Trek.
And he's done, plenty of independent movies, too.
He's done quite a few. He's actually directed some stuff. He's done a lot of theater. He's been in the entertainment industry for 50 years, which, as he says, is incredibly depressing for him. but he's done just about everything. I digress, as I often do. The plot follows Cade Ballard, played by Jeff Cannata, who is the former ambassador from the nation of Texas. It's 1876, and North America is actually occupied by five different nations. The Civil War has been going on for almost 20 years, and Cade Ballard actually is something of a celebrity because he saved Lincoln from being assassinated on a visit to Washington, D.C. He really isn't at home in his own country anymore, because while Texas was not at war with the North American Union, they weren't excited that he saved Lincoln from being assassinated, so he's not really welcome at home. He, in a sense, sort of feels like a man without a country, so he's wandering and just really trying to get away from this unwanted celebrity that he's achieved, and bumps into a woman named Guinevere Wheeler, who has been just about everything in the course of her life, played by Libby Letlow, who is largely an unknown, although anybody who was a huge fan of Masked Rider saw her as Patsy on that show when she was a child. And Guinevere is kind of a con artist, a grifter, comes from sort of a tough background, and when she meets Cade, she recognizes him, and, you know, as I phrased it to everybody in the auditions, I said, you know, these two characters are both sort of dissolute loners, and they bump into each other in these strange circumstances, and each is the first person the other has met in a long time that they genuinely find interesting. They end up meeting Walter's character, who has created this machine called the Temporal Engine that I'm not going to tell you exactly what it does, but you can guess it's something to do with time. I will tell you it is not a time machine.
Oh.
And a would-be world conqueror named Dr. Clay has gotten his hands on this thing, and all they know is it's incredibly dangerous, and they have to stop Clay from using it to destroy San Francisco. So.
Okay. So was San Francisco actually founded back then?
Yeah,
I don't remember.
Absolutely. we actually have it being a somewhat larger city than it was in 1876. It was largely just a seaport for bringing in gear for the railroads in the real 1876 and sort of a gold rush town. We have the Golden Gate Bridge a little early. The Golden Gate Bridge was actually built – oh, God, my effects guy is going to kill me. I think the Golden Gate Bridge was built in 81 was when construction was started, and in hours it's finished. But I mean, there's a whole sort of elaborate explanation for things that are advanced or things that happen at different times.
Yeah, I'm okay with taking poetic license with things, and I know because I'm friends with the guy who writes The Lone Ranger, and he says that he kind of gets like some flack sometimes about like when he refers to a city or something, and it's not an official state yet, or if it's not a whatever, and he, you know, the historians come out and give him grief.
Well, and we actually are. One of the things that we're giving away on Kickstarter is there. I mean, it's not incredibly detailed, but it's running like 40 pages right now. I'm in the process of writing it, but it's sort of this alternate history that tells you where things diverged and what that led to that has changed X, Y, and Z, and then what followed on from that, and why things are different in this world. But we try to be careful about it. I mean, even to things like Wyatt Earp makes tiny, tiny, tiny little one-line appearance in this movie in Dodge City. And in 1876, Wyatt Earp may or may not have been in Dodge City. Nobody really knows. So, okay, fine. He was in Dodge City. But I have the actual marshal of Dodge City, Larry Deager, being the marshal of Dodge City. So I just have him as a black man, which we don't know if he was or not. There's no photos. So.
Sure, why not?
But we try to do as much of our homework as we can, you know?
Because yeah, it's so funny. It's just such a weird coincidence because the story that I'm working on right now is the exact same time set in Pennsylvania. So it's like I'm all over Wikipedia trying to get the timelines of things straight. And sometimes I find names that they are a little bit different, so I'm wondering if it's just a mistake in whoever wrote the articles, and I can't quite tell. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is just grueling trying to write something factually historical.
Yeah, and the further back you go, the worse it gets.
Yeah, and like you said, trying to find photos. I mean, half of the men, literally, they all look the same.
Yeah, they're all that guy with the mustache.
The guy with the mustache and the hat.
Yeah, the guy with the mustache and the hat and the brown pants. That was you. Okay. Oh, I thought it was the other guy. Oh, it was. Yeah.
That's why people make fun of steampunk costumers. It's got
to.
But brown.
God bless them. We try not to.
Oh, I love it. It's fabulous. I mean, some of the work that they do is so incredible and ingenious.
It absolutely is. I mean, I'm, you know, to be brutally honest, we're toning it down a little bit for the movie.
Okay.
My take on the movie is I'm making a Western. And the steampunk elements enable me to tell this story because the story is about people fighting to stop the use of technology that didn't exist. And they're using technology that didn't exist to do it. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm making a Western. And the rest of that is all another layer that adds some depth to it. But it's not, quote unquote, what the movie is about. You know, we've had to, like, there are things that we've had to strip down to just make it believable, you know? I mean, you look at the League of Steam guys when you go to Comic-Con, and they've got these amazing costumes that they plainly cannot move in.
Right. Yeah, they're not quite functional.
And I have to examine that and go, okay, now, it's great in photos and it's gorgeous, but when I actually have people that have to, you know, roll around and fight in this stuff and draw a gun and do it – I got to be able to believe that it works.
Right. And that's, I imagine that's sort of hard with any of the medieval knights with armor, gladiators with armor, anything when you're sticking metal onto a person.
The only thing that's different with that, and it's funny because when I was a stuntman, I actually worked at medieval times, so I have a little bit of history with this. But
love you more.
The thing that's funny about that is that we have a reference. You know, we know what they actually wore. We have some idea of how it actually worked. And so we at least have some understanding of, okay, we know that somehow these guys actually were wearing this huge heavy plate with three layers of padding underneath it and functioned. We don't know, you know, and then figuring that out. And with stuff like steampunk, we're making it up as we go along. So I have to make it up, but still have it be believable.
That's cool. Now, I noticed that with some of the characters, there was this Arthurian vibe to it. Is that just a coincidence for the sake of the character names, or are you actually using some sort of King Arthur storyline for them, like as far as their character progression of the story?
It's not a King Arthur. It's an interesting question, and it's one that I've kind of had a discussion with Libby about this with her character, but we haven't really gotten into it. Is it's not that this story is any kind of Arthurian legend metaphor, but I believe in my head her past is a metaphor for the Arthurian legends. And so that was one of the reasons why I named her Guinevere. And it's not that, you know, Kate is not her Lancelot. Actually, her horse is named Lancelot.
Okay, that's why I saw that, yeah.
Yeah. But to a degree, her past to me is that metaphorical Arthurian legend. And so that's kind of where I like, you know, coming from with that.
Cool. All right, yeah, I mean, because I found it really interesting, and I thought, well, it could just be, you know, paying homage to it, or it could be a, you know, Easter eggs of something you're supposed to look for.
It's kind of all of that, you know. Okay. It was a jumping off point for her character, because that's always where I start, you know. Even in genre fiction, I try it. Like, the characters are ridiculously layered. If you saw the, I don't think anybody will ever see it because there's no point, but the 7 pages of notes that I sent Walter Koenig on his character's backstory when he wanted to know more about Professor Timian. And so I sent him this man's life story, and he wrote me back, and he's just like, that's insane. How much of this is in the movie? I said, none. It's just for you.
So that you can draw on it.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's very good. I think it's funny. I think some actors want to invent it themselves in their head, and others don't. They need to know what the motivation is. So,
and you know, and that happens. Actually, that happens a lot. That you'll run into people, and everybody brings, they all bring their own spice to the table. You know, it's just that everybody has to be eating the same meal at the end. So, like, Chase McKenna, who's playing one of the smaller parts, she plays Salome, who's a navigator on Dr. Clay's crew, the villain. And she loves doing her character bio and doing her character background and making up her character notes. And I have in my head what Salome's background is. But it doesn't matter as long as the end result gets to where I need it to go. So, you know, as long as her character background doesn't contradict anything that actually happens on screen or the motivations that happen on screen, then I'm fine with that. It's like,
okay, yeah, great. You know, and then, you know, are you going to have anything, like, one of the things that I like about the way that today's DVDs are released and everything is the extras and the commentary, and maybe one of the stars will have, like, their own video blog diaries of it. Are you doing anything like that?
Oh, my God, yes. there's going to be so much, because I'm, you know, I'm a huge Blu-ray DVD nerd, and I've done a lot of that stuff, and my friends do a lot of that for a living, and the amount of extras that we've already got in mind for the Blu-ray and the DVD are just kind of ridiculous. So there will be I hope that there won't be any deleted scenes, because it's a, you know, it's a short, so it'd be nice if everything we shoot actually works and ends up in the movie. But there will be, you know, a huge making of documentary. There's going to be commentary. We are starting to shoot video blogs now. I'm going to be doing one. James Dean's going to be doing one. My director of photography is going to be doing one. My other producer, Charles Mead, is going to be doing one. And then as we get closer to it, we're shooting things like on the 12th, we're having a table read in LA with the whole cast. Well, we're shooting that, and I don't know what we'll get out of it, but we'll get something interesting. When we do wardrobe fittings, we're going to be shooting that. There's going to be a ton of stuff.
Excellent. And now, let's see, your last update that I saw said that you're still in pre-production. So explain, as somebody who doesn't make films, explain to me you go from pre-production to production and then post. Like, is specifically only filming considered production?
Yes. Production starts on day one of shooting.
Okay.
Everything else is pre-production. So the day you start production is the single most terrifying moment up until the day that you show it to an audience. And the reason that it's terrifying is because I don't care if it's $100,000 or $100 million, there is never enough planning. There's just never enough time in pre-production. And the day that you have to actually, you know, stop thinking hypothetically and actually go shoot is just always the most terrifying day. And our first day is really terrifying because our first day is out in the Nevada desert with environment that we can't control and with all these elements that we can't control. And I'm going to have my Dr. Clay, who I still have to keep under wraps for the moment, out there. And I'm going to have Walter out there. And I'm going to have all of my actors out there. And I'm going to have extras out there. And I'm going to have just like, wow, let's fuck up big. If we're going to fuck up right at the start, let's just go for it.
Yeah, you're asking for Jaws kind of trouble there.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's me, Martha's Vineyard, and a shark that doesn't work. We're in.
Exactly. So then how's the schedule moving along? Like, at what point, because there was something about like 90 days you're shooting regardless.
Yeah. Well, what it is too is, you know, Kickstarter is awesome. And it's really kind of been great to use because we're getting to build sort of a fan base and a following before we've ever even made the movie, which normally for something like this, you don't really get a chance to do that. And it's been really nice, too, that we're actually, you know, we're starting to get some media penetration before we've ever even made the show, which that's great. Well, we need all of that we can get. But the thing about Kickstarter is, you know, if we don't get all of that money, we're still making the movie. I'm going to make this movie regardless, you know. It's just a question of how soon. So we would like to be shooting in April. Part of that is dependent upon what happens with the schedule of my Dr. Clay, who has a pretty hectic schedule. And then, of course, I'm working around Walter's schedule to an extent because despite the fact that he is 72 years old, he is he's one of the most energetic 72-year-olds I've ever met in my life, and is just constantly out doing stuff. And, you know, he's working on another project, and he's working on a book, and he's working on this, and he's doing conventions, and he's doing tours. And so we have to work around all of that. And then there are just logistics of, you know, we've got 3 days on location and we've got 4 days in LA and getting all of that done. It's all the planning takes time, but ideally we'll be shooting in April. We'll be wrapped. We'll be shooting in mid-April and we'll be done before the end of April. And then post-production starts and hopefully the movie will be completely finished by the end of July or the beginning of August. That'd be nice. So,
all right. Now, when it comes to a nice independent project like this, do you have to have considerations with the unions, like the Writers Union or the Actors Unions or anything?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. We're doing this under the SAG short film contract, which, you know, that allows us to – it allows us to not pay people, but we're paying people anyway. It allows us to pay people all deferred, which – being an actor myself, I'm not a big fan of. I think, you know, if you work, you get paid. That's the way it goes. And like the Joker said, if you're good at something, never do it for free. So, but yeah, that allows us to use both union and non-union actors. And the only thing it doesn't allow us to do in exchange for the fact that, you know, we don't owe people residuals because this really isn't a project for financial gain. It's not like this thing is ever going to make any money. That's not the point. So in exchange for that, we cannot, like, get anybody into the union. You know, I can't Taft-Hartley somebody and get them into SAG. If I could, I'm sure I could finance the entire thing just by casting the movie.
Right. Okay. But yeah, that's, you know, from when I had to take some theater in college, it was the theater director tried to explain to us that, well, you can't be in a SAG movie until you have your SAG card, which can't you get your card until you've been in a SAG movie. And I'm like, I don't understand what you just said.
Yeah, it has been one of the great catch-22s of all time. It's largely changed now that SAG and AFTRA are merged and are one big union. That's changed to an extent. And next year, it'll be a lot easier for people to get into SAG because AFTRA, you could just go join. You know, Okay. You could just go and say, I want to be an AFTRA, and they'd say, great, write a check. And so SAG has had to adopt some of those policies in that merger. So it's a little bit easier.
Okay, well, that's kind of good news. I like that.
Before that, it was always, like, you know, I got into SAG by doing stunt work in a right-to-work state. So I just got Taft-Hartley into something because I was a stuntman. Which was the whole reason I was doing stunts, because it was like, okay, how the fuck am I going to get in the Screen Actors Guild?
Exactly. And, you know, it's nice to have, like, insurance and stuff, right?
Well, I have actually, you know, you have to do – basically the only people who are ever eligible for SAG insurance are people who work so much that they don't need it.
Because they could just pay cash?
No, it's not that. But, you know, if you're on – if you're a regular on a TV series, then the studio's giving you insurance. You're an employee. You're getting paid weekly. You're getting everything. You get all of the other consideration. So the studio pays your health insurance because they want to keep you healthy. And I forget what it is now. You have to have something like 28 weeks of work to get SAG insurance. The only actors that work 28 weeks are actors who are on a network show. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
See, all these little nuances that people don't think about.
Yeah. So.
And you had mentioned some of your other producers. We have James Dean, Charles Mead, Ryan Carter, and you just announced Melissa Kimbrough today.
Yes. Melissa Kimbrough is a friend of mine I've known forever and ever and ever. She is actually a retired adult star, but also, you know, pursuing mainstream acting, pursuing several things. And she had actually wanted to audition for one of the roles in the movie. And then because of scheduling, she actually couldn't make it. And it's kind of driven her crazy this entire time that she was not able to get involved with this thing. And as she's seen it sort of growing and growing and growing, she finally just decided, you know what, I have the money in the bank. What do you think? And I said, I think it'd be great. And she's taken it so seriously. Last night, she was on the phone with me, just giving me the third degree about, okay, where do things stand? Where do things stand with casting? What's up with this guy? Because we have an actor we're having issues with. She's like, hey, what are you guys doing about this? When's the reading? What are we scheduling? What's next for press? I'm like, okay, you're doing the job. This is awesome.
That's great. I love it. It's great news.
And Ryan Carter, yeah, he's my VFX supervisor. So in a sense, he's the most important guy in the show. It all rests on his shoulders. If it looks like crap, it's going to be his fault.
I was going to ask how much you have to rely on CGI work for this.
More than I'd like. Christopher Nolan is one of my favorite directors, and that's so for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is that if it is possible to build something for real and then just augment it with CG, he will. And that's really, if I had the money, how I would rather approach things. But I just can't build a working mechanical horse. I don't have that budget. Lady Gaga does, but I don't. I can't. We have this creature called the Myrmidon that there are sketches of on the website that, you know, I would love to be able to really build this thing, this sort of half tank, half dead Union soldier. And, but I can't. I don't have the money. So it's going to be a real actor, with, you know, makeup appliances and some real pieces put in there to sort of fool the eye, and then CGI augmentation. It's just the only way I can go about it. So I have to rely really heavily on him. And if it were anybody else, I'd be scared to death. But I've worked with him enough, and I have enough faith in him that the thing that he does that really calms me down is he will tell me when he can't do something. And effects guys are infamous for telling you they can do anything and then figuring out how to do it after the fact. And there will be things that he will tell me straight out. He just, I can't do that, or I don't know how to do that. And there are a couple of things that we don't know how to do that we're figuring out. We're actually figuring out the solutions for those. So, you know, and then there's stuff that obviously would always be CG in any form, like, you know, the rockets. We're not going to build 12 story Victorian era rockets. That's just not going to happen. Nobody would. Dr. Clay's Zeppelin, you know, in the modern world, that would never be a model. That's always going to be CG. So it's like, okay, great. So we've got this Zeppelin that you know, it's going to be scary looking as hell, but it's going to be completely practical looking and has these huge steel ribs around the outside and all that. It's going to look amazing, and there's no way it was ever going to be real. So I'm fine with that stuff.
Okay. Well, that's cool. But the, you know, the fact that you've got amazing actors with a fantastic wardrobe and stuff, that's a great start.
Really, that's always my favorite special effect, is a really good actor.
Yeah. I mean, and now is James taking on an acting role, or is he staying behind the scenes?
Producing. We talked about it when I very first approached him about doing this, and the fact is he's just not in the script. You know, I could have tried to rewrite somehow and put him in as the lead, and it was something that we discussed, but he's just not right for it. You know, unless he ends up doing some little cameo in one of the small parts, which I may end up doing a little cameo in one of the small parts, I don't know. Unless he ends up doing that, no, he's not going to be in the movie.
Okay. Now, is this the first time you two have worked together?
I've known him for probably 8 years now. It's my fault that he started getting acting work in the adult business, because before then, all he had ever wanted to do were movies where he showed up and did a sex scene and went home, or maybe did some kooky stuff for Joanna Angel in one of her movies. And I put him in a movie called Corruption that was a heavy-duty acting part, because I'd met him and I'd shot him. And I knew that because I come from a mainstream background, so I kind of feel like I analyze this stuff differently than a lot of people in adult do. And I knew that he had the ability to be very real on camera, that he could just be very natural. And I'm a huge fan of very naturalistic acting. So I threw him in this big acting part, and other than the fact that he was really complaining about the makeup that we had to put on him when he got killed in the movie, he was amazing. He was really good. And I showed that to people in the industry, and Brad Armstrong watched it from Wicked Pictures and started hiring him all the time. And so, you know, he's partly my fault. I always tell him, I kind of look at him and go, that's my boy.
Well, he truly has that all American boy look to him. I mean, he's just so classically appealing, like American style, you know, like you just picture him running on a football field or something.
Which, you know, the thing, of course, I mean, this is true for any actor. But the thing that's funny is, for those of us who know him and who know him well, there is nothing I can less picture him doing. But that's just because I know him. You're right. That absolutely is his persona. You know, he is the boy next door. until you see him do something like the stuff that, you know, he did in the Canyons, where he's incredibly surly and incredibly angry and incredibly dark, and you see that core of just, you know, pure evil that all of us know and love. So it's in there. It's in there.
But that's good. I mean, you know, that's an actor with range.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, he was the boy wonder, right?
Yep. He was. If, you know, that wacky 60s era Batman stuff. I don't know. That's more like commedia dell'arte than just acting, I think.
Yeah, but that was such a great, that was a great movie.
Absolutely.
Because Cowboys and Engines is steampunk and period at the same time, I need to know about the costumes and the props. Where are, you know, are you using one studio to have all of these things made, or are you having, like,
from all over the place? My main costumer is Ty Lombardi, who has done a lot of mainstream work, and I'm getting sketches in from her now on stuff that she wants to do for the characters that I haven't posted yet. But her stuff is just amazing, and it's more than any one person can handle. So there's going to be some stuff that gets farmed out. There's going to be some stuff that's, you know, purchased or off the rack and modified. I mean, and the same is true of props. You know, we're there's some stuff that we're making. There's some stuff that we're buying. There's some stuff that we're getting and modifying. You know, it's coming from a lot of different places. I've had people come out of the woodwork like crazy. They're just like, I do this, I do this, I do this, I do this. I'm like, great, terrific. Yeah, let's figure out how this all works. And you know, my production designer is going to be sourcing a lot of stuff out. And there's one set that's kind of scaring the hell out of us that we have to build, we'll get it done. But yeah, it's all being sourced through a number of different people in a number of different venues, because it just, there's no way, especially on a budget that we have. It's not like I can just build a department and say, okay, here's the designs, make me this, which, you know, that's how they do it in the real world, and we can't do that.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine, you know, one of my favorite shows is Once Upon a Time, and just the how much real estate they must have just for the wardrobe department is, it's got to be insane.
I'm sure that it's that's Disney, right? Yes, I'm sure that, you know, they have an entire workshop at the Burbank Studios that is just, you know, out of control, would be my guess.
Now, when this is done and you're all set, what is the distribution going to be like? And, you know, are you going to do screenings around the country or anything?
Well, it's designed to be a film festival piece. And there's a number of reasons behind that. You know, to quote Baldrick from Blackadder, I have a cunning plan. What it is, the script actually breaks down into three versions of the movie that we're doing, the short. One is targeted at film festivals that accept shorts up to half an hour. And that's what we're going to call the festival cut. And what that is the entire opening scene of the movie, which more or less plays as its own little encapsulated story between just Guinevere and Cade. And then selected scenes from the rest of the full feature script that more or less give you the arc of the story. They give you the bones. They don't give you a lot of the meat, but you get the idea, and they'll keep you entertained. Then for festivals that only allow shorts 10 minutes and under, it will just be that opening scene with maybe a few select flashes from the rest of the movie, almost like it turns into a trailer. And then there will be just a trailer, an extended trailer, like a 3.5-minute trailer for the movie. And for probably at least the first year after we get this thing done, other than the people who have gone on Kickstarter and gotten the DVD or the Blu-ray, which is going to ship as soon as the movie's done, the only place that people are going to be able to see those two long cuts is at a festival somewhere or at a screening, because for that first year, it's not going to be online. It's not going to be available. We're trying to keep it somewhat exclusive and trying to keep some buzz behind it. The trailer will go online, and the trailer will be on our website. The trailer will be on YouTube. But other than DVD or Blu-ray, it's going to be at festivals. Our plan is, and we already have a tacit agreement with them, pending the fact that, you know, I don't completely fuck up the movie. Our plan is to start the festival run in Sitges in Spain, at the Sitges Film Festival. And then probably I'd like to end the festival run the following year, if we can get in, which I think we probably can, to at Midnight Madness in Toronto. So then that would mean that the American festival run would either hopefully start at Slam Dance in 2014 or at South by Southwest in 2014 would be the first American festival screenings.
Okay.
And the reason that we're doing it that way is that while this movie is not ever designed to make any kind of a profit, it is a great idea for either – I actually have a producer who wants to try and turn it into an HBO series. I have somebody else that wants to try and turn it into a feature, and there is a full feature script. So, you know, we want to take it to festivals. We want to get it seen, and we want to see if anybody bites on trying to make it something bigger. And if not, we did something we're all proud of, and that's fine.
Okay. One of the reasons that I was curious is because here in New Jersey, we are the home of the Steampunk World Fair. And I didn't know if you actually planned on doing any actual, like, small-scale screenings at convention-type settings as opposed to the bigger festival settings.
Absolutely. Like, we'll be at Comic-Con next year. We'll be at Gen Con. We'll be at WizardCon. You know, we'll be at all of those. And things like, the Steampunk World's Fair, they do the – I can't remember what the cruise is that they do in out of New Orleans, the steampunk cruise. We'll absolutely be doing things like that.
Oh, that's really cool. That's very exciting.
I know. Again, as long as the movie doesn't suck, which if it does, that'll be my fault.
If it does, then we're blaming Ryan, right?
Right. No, I'm blaming Ryan. Everyone else will blame me. That's okay. The way it goes. And then they'll be right, too. That's okay.
Okay. So now with Kickstarter, because you have to meet the goal or you don't get any of the funding that you raise, why did you choose Kickstarter instead of something else like Indiegogo?
Well, there's a couple reasons why. I think one is Kickstarter, to me, is more geek-friendly. You know, the successful – like nerd and geek projects, the ones that my people want to see that have been funded on Kickstarter. Indiegogo really does seem like more of a, I want to make a movie about my band and the guy that commits suicide site. It really does seem like it's a little bit more of a youth oriented pop culture project website. Now that being said, if we end up running into trouble in post and needing additional money, we also figured, okay, well, we'll go hit Indiegogo and see if we can, you know, get a different group of people, because then we'll actually have footage and we can show it, or we'll do another Kickstarter or whatever. But Kickstarter also just seems to be a much more well-known. You know, Kickstarter is the eBay of auctions, and Indiegogo is still the Amazon.com of auctions. Most people don't even remember that Amazon.com ever had auctions.
Right. That's usually what people say, is that Kickstarter is just brand recognition. And also apparently the rewards way that it's set up is different or easier.
I can speak to that because, to be honest, we decided and we didn't really investigate the nuts and bolts of Indiegogo. So, you know, if we try and go that way, I may be horrified to discover that, you know, I have to give them ownership of my cats or something. I don't know, which is fine. They can have my cats.
Aww.
My cats are pain.
Aw, how many are there?
Well, three or four if you count the really fat one twice.
See, I'm down to one, and she has completely abandoned me because I'm not the one who feeds her in the house anymore, so she doesn't care about me anymore.
You're not the important human.
I'm not.
They only care about the thumbs. Who has the thumbs? Okay, fine.
Yeah, I don't pop open the, I don't make the can popping noise. But if I get the Ready Whip can for when I make cocktails, she comes running because she loves the Ready Whip.
Okay, see, I don't drink, so you have to explain to me, what on earth does Ready Whip have to do with cocktails?
I really use it a lot in my summer drinks. When I do, I do a lot of, like, just throw frozen shit into a blender and add rum.
Okay. I mean, I don't have an opinion. I don't know. I've just never heard this. So, like, I'm fascinated. Like, all right, whipped cream, sure. Well, fake whipped cream.
Yeah, fake whipped cream, yeah.
I guess you wouldn't want real whipped cream in something with alcohol, would you?
I guess they do, or there's a certain amount of things. Like, I think the Godiva liqueur, I think some of the liqueurs actually do have dairy, like Bailey's.
Well, that keeps the hipsters from drinking them, I guess.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I don't really like, yeah, I do a lot of the soy milk version.
Yeah, exactly.
So, well, that's good. So you're a cat person, and you worked at Medieval Times, and you were a stuntman. You're getting more lovable by the second.
I that's only because you don't know me. I'm probably one of the least lovable people you've ever spoken to. Just ask my friends.
But you have friends.
I do. Primarily, I think they just stay around so they can tell me what a prick I am most of the time.
Everybody needs one of those, right? Everybody's got that friend in the circle that you just hate.
Yeah, that'd be me.
That's you? Okay.
Such an asshole.
Oh, he's here again.
That's right. If they see me smiling, they say, what's wrong?
Aw.
Which I guess is a bad sign. I don't know. I kind of find it funny.
No, I find smiling is very useful because then people wonder what you're up to.
Yeah, well, me for sure. They know it's got to be something. This did not happen organically. What are you about?
So here we've got this great project that we're talking about, Cowboys and Engines. And but, you know, a lot of you are coming from the adult entertainment business. So are you guys just moving on? Is that a chapter that's behind you now?
Oh, God, no. I mean, I'll admit, probably for me, I mean, half my work last year was mainstream. I did a movie, I shot camera on a movie in Alabama, and I spent a month in Moscow shooting a documentary, and I shot a horror movie that's actually getting theatrical release this year called Eye Killer. But the mainstream industry is dying too. So, you know, it's not like there's any one place you can go to make a living. You do what you can do to make a living. And as far as James Dean, you know, he's been very clear about the fact that he does not expect to, quote, go mainstream. What it really is that, you know, I said in a New York Times interview like 8 years ago or 6 years ago or something that porn is Hollywood divested of the pretense of art. And that's really what it is we make tools. You know, we make masturbatory tools. And when I made Upload in 2007, which was a $350,000 movie, that and you know, we won just about every award we could win, and people said this is the greatest adult film that's ever been made, which makes it only slightly less respectable than the worst mainstream film that's ever been made, which I would argue is The Beast of Yucca Flats. So it gets frustrating making widgets, because by and large, that's what we do. We make widgets day in, day out. And there comes a time where, you know, you get frustrated at not really being able to tell a story. Now, I wrote this script in 2009. So that's how long it's taken me to get around to actually making it happen. And we actually decided to do it last year around the beginning of April. So that's how long it's taken to just even get Kickstarter going. And, you know, everything just takes time, because it's what John Lennon said, you know, life is what happens. But we need to do it. I need to do it. I'll lose my mind if I don't do something that I can really, really, really creatively invest in. Porn is fun. There's nothing wrong with the business. It is what it is. And I've done a lot of things that feel exactly the same as porn. I directed four movies for Roger Corman. And let me tell you, they were way worse than making porn. Nobody gave a shit about anything on those movies.
Right.
I did a movie where Mickey Rourke was my lead, and I had him for a day. One day, he's the lead in my movie. Okay, I don't know how I make that work. Well, you cut pages, you cheat stuff, you fix it, whatever. And he didn't give a shit. He showed up 2 hours late, and the first words out of his mouth were, "When's lunch?"
You know? Oh, my God.
So and that's way worse than doing porn. So porn is fine. It's just not scratching the itch. And I don't think it's scratching the itch for Brian and, you know, for James Dean, excuse me. And not that that's any big secret. It's on his itch. So that's why we're doing it. You know, we're doing it because we all need something else. But it's not – I don't have any realistic expectation that, you know, especially coming from a porn background, it's not like, it's not like HBO is going to be on the phone offering me episodes of Game of Thrones season 4 to direct. That's not going to happen, right? So, you know, we're making it for us. That's why we're doing it. We're making it to make something that we really care about.
Well, it's just interesting because, like you said, you're not feeling the creative fulfillment, with a lot of those movies and how they're shot like in a day and like the most ridiculous grueling hours from what I understand. And, you know, you should do like 20 movies in a week. And to me, that's no different than people living the 9-to-5 grind in cubicles and, completely unfulfilled. And you get home and you're in a rock band, or you get home and you go log into Warcraft and, you know, whatever it takes to find some sort of excitement about life that's outside of your paycheck.
And that's really what this is. You know, I saw on one blog site where somebody had posted that they thought that the Kickstarter thing was probably just a scam and that we were trying to get money because we were going to turn around and then just make a porn version of the thing with the costumes. And I'm like, man, you could not be – there is wrong – and there is wrong. And you could not be more wrong than thinking that we want porn anywhere involved in this project. We only brought it up because we know it's going to come up. And, you know, it's not like we're not avoiding it. We're not ashamed of it. But this ain't that.
And that's why I was like, I was so glad that it was really upfront. And he's just like, yeah, I'm James Dean. Yeah, I'm that James Dean. Because one of the things that bugged the living crap out of me in the last, month or so is, and mind you, I've heard this before because I do nude modeling and.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, I'm fine. Like, and I don't care. But like when people, tell me, oh, well, that'll come up in your background check and you won't get hired for a job. And it's true. And I've had a really hard time finding work. I'm just like, you know what, if an employer of some corporation that is only going to consider me a number anyway, cares that I'm naked on the internet,
right,
then I don't want to work for them.
Right.
And it doesn't bother me. It just bothers me that that's out there. First of all, the fact that there's so much porn sold and illegally downloaded that it's so high grossing financially, and yet people are going to pretend like it's this naughty secret that nobody cares about and I'll never get a job, or you'll never get a job, or so I didn't know what kind of crap people could possibly be giving you about it.
Well, it's a little, and to be honest, it's expected. What I've also I've seen a little bit of the, well, how good can it be, the guy's a porn director. I'm like, okay, well, that's fair. I've made some really awful movies. I admit that, absolutely.
But there's really awful mainstream movies too,
And I've made a few that I'm really proud of too. My favorite thing I have ever done to date was a porn movie that I'm really proud of. And that's not something that, that's not anything that anybody's going to be able to take away from me. It's not something that a lot of people can say. But that being said, a lot of people, it's not me, a lot of people busted their ass to make that movie happen. But it doesn't change the fact, to me, it's a genre that is no different from, pick something, it's no different from commercials, it's no different from music videos, it's no different from, I mean, a lot of things that don't carry that stigma. It's a purpose-driven media product.
Right. And I mean, personally, I'd rather watch that than the blood gore fests that are allowed to have commercials on television and, you know, and are allowed to be shown in every single movie theater. Like, I mean, the Hostels and the Saw and the Friday the 13th and all that stuff. It's like, I don't want to see that. I'd much rather see beautiful naked bodies.
Yeah. I mean, even though I've shot, I didn't direct it, but even though I've shot a horror movie, we call it a horror movie. It wasn't. It was a thriller. It was more like Hitchcock than anything else. It was just a psychological thriller. You barely see anything at all in the movie. But I'm not a huge fan of horror. I'm not, you know.
But to me, like, I just get so frustrated by it. Like, the fact that I didn't watch the Super Bowl, but the commercials – I saw that, you know, Pornhub wasn't allowed to advertise and they obviously released what their commercial would have been. And it was like this adorable commercial of these two old people sitting on a park bench and they hold hands and they look at each other and just says Pornhub.com underneath. And that couldn't run because it's advertising a porn website. But these like disgusting other commercials, like, you know, the GoDaddy commercials and this one with like the Geico pig and like this woman hitting on him like she's about to fuck the pig.
Is it Spain?
It what?
Spain? I hear they do that in Spain. of course, you know, being inside the industry, the thing that's funny to me about that is, you know, that's like the whole Pornhub thing is it's great marketing.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant.
Oh yeah, because they got a ton of
like they were ever actually going to take the spot. And we know that they're not going to take the spot. So Pornhub can ask because they know that they're not going to be expected to pony up the whatever $6 million or what it would have cost to run the spot because they wouldn't have paid it. So it's brilliant free marketing. Here's our commercial. Will you take it for the Super Bowl? No. You won't? It's totally disingenuous. It's brilliant. It's genius. It's
absolutely, yeah, because then it ends up on the Huffington Post and everybody sees it anyway.
Like, okay. And had I been in charge of the media, if I had been one of the media buyers, I would have turned out, yeah, fuck you. We'll take it. Oh, how much? $1 million? Will you take a check? Post until 2026? But you're absolutely right. You know, there's always – but that double standard isn't going to go away. And in a sense, I almost don't know that I want it to because there was a director. He's long dead now. I'm trying to think of his stage name because all I can remember is his real name. Oh, God damn it. What was Ron's? It'll come to me. Henri Pichard. And Henri Pichard always said he used to get so angry at people that wanted to mainstream porn and wanted to talk about, you know, porn becoming more acceptable and porn becoming more respectable. He used to say, you know, fuck that. We don't want to be – the minute we become respectable is the minute that we become irrelevant. People watch porn because it's dirty and because it's wrong and because it's what they can't get. And the minute that it becomes respectable is the minute that it becomes boring. And I work for some very respectable porn companies, and he is so right. You know, to an extent, it's what has kept me – that and the fact that I don't do drugs is what has kept me from going to Burning Man. And the fact that I grew up in the desert and never need to spend a week in the desert ever again in my life is that I turned down an opportunity – to go shoot camera on a documentary on the second Burning Man, which was, I believe, the first one in the desert, because I think the first Burning Man was on a beach in San Francisco, and then they got kicked out. And I turned it down because it was going to be my camera, and there's no way I was going to take my camera and expose it to that environment for a week. I figure if I turned down Burning Man 2, there's no way I'm going to Burning Man, I don't know, 18 or whatever it is now. Because now they have Playa Police, and they have an art council that has to approve your art car, and they have rules for this and rules for this, and you can't do this, and you have to do this, and you have to do that, and they're suing people for taking photos of the art and using them on the internet. I'm like, you know what, guys? You may have started out counterculture, but guess what? Now you're the man. You are now, you have now jumped the shark. You are now no longer counterculture. You are now the culture. Burning Man has become respectable.
Now it's just a business.
It's just, now it's just a bunch of wannabe hippies doing drugs in the desert for a week. Like, okay, well, that's great. Terrific.
I wonder what happened with the Occupy movement, too.
Well, yeah, it's exactly the same thing. Everything over time gets co-opted. And it's just, it's the nature of all human society. Eventually, everything gets corrupted. Everything falls in on itself. It's just the way things happen. It's the nature of big systems and little systems. It's entropy. All systems fall apart. And I'm okay with that. That's the nature of things. But I do like to point out that, you know, for our business, we really don't need to aspire to acceptability because it's not in our best interest in any way other than making us look needy and grasping and like, oh, we want to be a part. We want to be a part. Well, we're not, and we're never going to be. We shouldn't be. You know, I've been saying for years, porn is the island of misfit toys. Nobody ends up in this business because they are completely normal, rational, and well-adjusted. We're all slightly broken in some way. And a lot of the people who I know who have been in the business for years and years and years, and I'm coming up on 20, I've been in 23 years. How is that possible? You can't imagine them anywhere else. I mean, where else are they going to go? Where else is Christina Rose going to go? There's no other place for that girl. You know, without porn, she ceases to exist. So, I don't know. It's my little diatribe about the mainstreaming of porn.
But there's, you know, how do you think that things have changed in the last year with the, you know, the 50 Shades popularity, which confessions I have no interest in reading because the grammar is terrible. I like grammar.
The face I'm making.
I mean, like the whole mommy porn and making porn more accessible to women who don't, you know, so they feel less dirty.
Yeah, here's the thing is I can go, I've been doing this long enough now that I get to be sort of like top cop on the bullshit squad for this kind of stuff. And I can go back through the last more than 20 years before I was even in porn. And I could point out to you examples of exactly the same thing. Going all the way back to Tropic of Cancer and or Tom Lehrer's version, Tropic of Calculus.
Last Tango in Paris.
Tango in Paris. The Nancy Friday books that were bestsellers, top of the charts, Forbidden Flowers and My Secret Garden, and those books that were all about, you know, unlocking women's sexual fantasies and now it's okay, and, you know, all the Helen Gurley Brown stuff that we're taking it back, and we're somehow every 3 or 4 years we seem to decide that women have yet again locked away their sexuality and need an excuse to use it. And that's just the mainstream media in their constant feeding frenzy of looking for this year's story. And they like talking about sex because sex sells. You know, when I ran AVN magazine, I used to see it three times a year during sweeps. All the network news would come knocking on our door looking to do a story about porn. We're looking for female directors. We're looking for this. We're looking for that every year because it sold. And it got them ratings. And all 50 Shades of Grey is this year's flavor of we're unlocking. This is porn for women. Okay, well, so was this, and so was this, and so was this. A and B, like most of those other examples, no, it isn't. No, it is not. It's not porn at all. What it is embarrassing.
It was so funny though seeing news anchors like Elizabeth Vargas blush when they had to talk about it.
And that is, to me, the most entertaining part, is taking great joy in the discomfort of people. You know,
when Pussy Riot got arrested, how many news anchors had to say Pussy Riot?
Exactly. Which was amazing. But, you know, I mean, those books are so tame compared to, like, the My Secret Garden, the Nancy Friday book about women's sexual fantasies that was a top-of-the-charts bestseller, has rape fantasies, gangbangs, bestiality. 50 Shades of Grey has handcuffs and it's controversial. Give me a fucking break.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm Game of Thrones, I couldn't sit through, like, I'm the only person that doesn't like the show. And my friends, like, devour the books, and they religiously watch the show and everything, and I'm just like, I don't get this. This is about, like, rape and incest. This is not my thing.
Yeah, absolutely it is. It absolutely is. It's you know, it's all the fun stuff that but there's a history of that in fantasy books. If you go back to the gore novels, those awful they were written under pseudonym. I forget whose pseudonym they originally were written under, but you know, the Tribes of Gore and the Men of Gore, and those were sold by Tor Fantasy, and there was something like 30 books in the series, and all they were about was BDSM. That's all those books were. But they were marketed as fantasy because you couldn't market a line, you know, and sell it in B. Dalton Booksellers and Walden Books. So all 50 Shades of Grey is an excuse for people to make money. That's why we're talking about it. That's why you and I are talking about it. That's why the mainstream media are talking about it, is because everything now more than ever in our history is about how do we make money off something new? We can't. We're only making money off of retreads of things that are old. Holy shit, here's something new. Maybe this is the next Twilight, only it's not for 12-year-olds. Oh my God, 40-year-old women actually have money. They'll spend it on something. We can get every woman who went to see Magic Mike to go see this movie in the theater. Holy shit, yes!
That's exactly it, isn't it? They realize women have money.
Yes, and they want it. They want all of it. So
when I was at Exotica, there actually was, like, they actually sort of, like, took the theme, because I'm sure they didn't pay any licensing for it. They had, like, you know, a 50 Shades, you know, aisle.
Yes.
And, you know, and they had their own dungeon at Exotica and stuff like that. It was off in its own little section. But it was open, so you could, like, watch if you wanted to, like, learn about stuff. And it's just so funny, because I'm just like, you know, those people are not going to come to Exotica.
Oh. They're not going to come to Exotica. They're not going to step anywhere near it. They may buy the porn ripoffs. There are, I think, now 3 50 Shades ripoffs. And it's possible that some of those are selling to those people. I don't know. I'm skeptical. You know, the movie will make a fortune, and it will make it all in matinees. It's going to be the only movie that opens to a $40 million weekend and nobody went to see it at night. Because it's going to be exactly like Magic Mike. It's going to be a bunch of women who sneak off during the day to go see this movie about male strippers.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but whatever. If the only reason it's embarrassing is it's just such a badly written, insulting book. You know, I have a dungeon in my home, so I find that kind of stuff just deeply insulting. And
because, like, I know nothing, like, virtually nothing about it. I listen to Polly Weekly, and that's, like, the most education that I will ever get on the subject. And it's just so funny where, you know, when I read, oh my God, the Goodreads reviews of 50 Shades are hilarious. They are the reviews are the best. It's sort of like reading Amazon reviews. But when Minx, you know, did a special, she's just like, this, she's like, people tell me about this book, and this is not what my life is like.
No, and it's, I struggled through the first one, and that was enough for me. So who knows, maybe 2 and 3 are the best written books on the planet. I just find it hard to believe that the first one is atrocious. It is so badly written. It's not a book. It's event coverage of events in progress. I mean, it's, I don't know. It's just terrible. And they're not particularly interesting, and they're not at all kinky. I mean, I don't know where – I think the entire reputation comes from the cover of the book. It's like, oh, there's handcuffs. Woo. I don't know.
Well, like I said, brilliant marketing.
Absolutely. Somebody deserves a raise and probably has gotten it many times over. So.
Yeah, whoever the book designer was, you know, They sort of like the same thing with Twilight, obviously, which is where it comes from. That sort of that font with those particular diffused vignette, you know, oversaturated photographs, and that style is completely copied on so many books.
I mean, it's funny because I've always said about the porn industry that we lead by following. Somebody stumbles onto a good idea that is actually making money, and suddenly everyone else emulates that idea. And this is a case where I feel like the mainstream has done exactly the same thing. They're leading by following, which someone stumbled onto this because it's not anything that any big publisher was ever going to come anywhere near. They would have said, oh, no, 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 there's no market for this. We can't do it. What? They're buying it? They're buying – holy shit, we have to get these into Walmart. And all I had to do to know that that was the case was look at how incredibly cheaply made those books are. They look like self-published books. They're the cheapest little trade paperbacks you can possibly make.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody saying, well, okay, we just want to sell a million of these as quickly as possible because I think tomorrow this is all going to be over. And I think that's probably true because there isn't now a contender for that crown. You know, there's not a follow-up. And so now they're just trying to exploit that series as much as they possibly can.
No, and E.L. James, she did an interview on one of these American talk shows, and she just looked so dreadfully uncomfortable. She never looked up. She was always looking down at the floor, and her leg was bouncing sort of nervously. And the funny thing is when I've seen interviews with Kristen Stewart, she looked exactly the same way. I'm like, these are two women who are completely embarrassed by their choices and careers or something. I don't know what's wrong with them.
Correct me if I'm wrong, who you can't believe have ever had good sex in their lives.
Exactly.
First. It was kind of like when Dr. Ruth was popular as a sex therapist. Like, somewhere, something's wrong with this picture.
Yeah, but I mean, I can remember being a teenager and, you know, my friends talking about, I was such a lame teenager. I would fall asleep at like 9 o'clock like I do now. And my friends talking about staying up late to watch Dr. Ruth.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I'm like, why? And they're, you know, and they're like, oh, shucks, about sex. I'm like, I don't care, I'm too tired.
Well, I'm convinced that the only reason Dr. Ruth became popular was the fact that you could not imagine this woman ever having sex.
Exactly.
So it was completely harmless.
You know, all to make fun of her.
Because you knew Dr. Ruth has never had a dick in her mouth. There's no way. Not a chance. Didn't happen. And if it did, I don't want to think about it. It's worse than my mother.
No, it is. She was like a grandmother when I was young.
Exactly. So she was probably, you know, only old when I was young. Because I'm in the Middle Ages.
But maybe she just came out that way. Maybe she's like a pod person. She just landed and she's always been that age.
It did look exactly the same.
Yeah.
This used to be a fascination for me. I was just like, how do you hire this woman to talk about sex? And I remember looking up once a picture of Dr. Ruth when she was fresh out of college. And she did. She looked like a little old Yenta when she was 20. So
very different hearing Stoya talk about having a dick in her mouth versus Dr. Ruth.
A little bit. Well, you know, plus you have visual aids.
Yeah.
Like, and here is Stoya. And we take you now live to footage of Stoya with a dick in her mouth.
She's just the best.
She's pretty hysterical. She's pretty goddamn funny.
Now, how do you feel about the trying to coax the tabloid celebrities into, you know, we'll give you $1 million to make porn, like Octomom, and Casey Anthony was offered it. And she said, no, this one pisses me off because I think she's a vile human being. But she, the fact that she like got off on most of those charges, she has $800,000 of legal debt and she's filing bankruptcy to wash away her debt. And I'm like, dude, you were offered $1 million to make porn. Go fucking make it. Pay off the people you owe.
Yeah. Well, let me say this about that. Nine times out of ten, I'm more ashamed by that stuff than anything that our industry has ever done on purpose, you know.
But paying for it.
And I work for Vivid a lot, and I and many, many, many other people, when that when that press release about Casey Anthony went out, we all emailed in and corporate and said, "Are you out of your fucking mind?"
Yeah.
You know, they'll tell you there's no such thing as bad press. Welcome to bad press. This is it. Right here. This is it. Octomom was skirting the same thing. Like, really? Not even, and then of all the companies for Brazzers to do it and then saddle Wicked with it. And I know the people at Wicked. They were not happy with that. Like, really? We have to take Nadia Suleiman's solo tape? Okay, fine. most of the other cases, it's not that big a deal because, you know, all of the ridiculousness about, oh, this tape got stolen from my home, and it's all bullshit. Everyone, with the sole exception of there's one exception. All of them are rigged. All of them are faked. All of them are arranged. And all of the Sturm und Drang over. I never wanted this to be seen by the public. This was never supposed to be. That's all press. Those tapes are all planned out. They're all. I mean, you have to have releases from people. You have to have their IDs. It's federal law. You can't. You don't get to steal a tape from someone's home, release it publicly, and not get sued. It just doesn't happen that way. So all of the rest of them have all been arranged. Paris Hilton's was arranged, but they were all arranged deals. So, you know, if those people want to get a payday to turn around and sell it, well, fine, whatever. I don't care. I just wish they would admit it.
Yeah, instead of it being like a Blair Witch of porn.
Right, exactly. You know, because frankly, we could make a better product if you just come in and let us shoot.
Yeah. And because it is really funny how it's so capitalized where, you know, the Paris Hilton was one, Kardashians, of course. But the one that I remember was like Pam Anderson. It was like her honeymoon.
Pam Anderson thing. Really did kind of get that's the one that she really did not want that out. And that, you know, she really did fight and she really did try and stop that. And she just had a really, really bad lawyer who made all the wrong arguments. So that was the sole case where it was actually something a little bit different. But I've met Pam and she's sweet and not the sharpest tool in the shed. You know, she kind of is exactly what you would imagine she is, which is kind of a shame. I mean, she's a damaged little girl who just kind of doesn't get it, you know? So
I sort of had that same idea that's probably what Anna Nicole was like, too.
Although I have heard from people who knew her that Anna Nicole was also just pure evil, which I don't have a hard time.
To be evil, I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. I always feel like you have to kind of be smarter to be evil, but then I've known some really pure evil people who were rock stupid, so maybe not.
Huh.
Maybe you just have to be smarter to be successful at being evil.
Yeah, maybe that's it. I don't know. There's got to be a philosophy in there somewhere.
There is. There is. I think it's called. Oh, I'm not going to say it. Okay. I just came up with so many things I could have said.
Aw, you're holding back. You're showing such a restraint.
As my grandfather liked to used to say, the sun even shines on a dog's ass once in a while.
Harry Brin, well, I, you know, this has been such an amazing opportunity for me to talk to you.
Oh, well, I'm thrilled and honored to have been invited. I appreciate it.
So I know that the website for the movie is officially launched now. So it's cowboysandenginesthemovie.com.
The easier thing that I tell people is mercifully now we're out there enough. You can just Google Cowboys and Engines and you'll find us.
True. Yeah. And that's the one thing about Kickstarter that I don't like is I don't really like their filtering and searching and stuff. But I think if you know specifically what title you're looking for, you can find it.
Yes. If you Google Cowboys and Engines, generally The top of the list is our website, and then the second thing down is our Kickstarter. So you'll find it. We need money. Go give us money. If you don't want to give us money, go copy the link and send it to your friends and family and tell them you gave us money. They're not going to know the difference, and maybe they'll give us money. Because really, if everyone who is hearing this would buy us a Starbucks, we could make the movie. So
yeah, and we swear to God, it's not porn.
It's not porn. It has nothing to do with porn. There's not even nudity. There's not even really skin. I think my lead is in her bloomers at one point. I think that's about as close to porn as you get. So
I think it'd be funny, though, if somebody wants to do a Cowboys and Engines porn parody.
Hey, let them. Absolutely.
So, awesome. You've got what, like halfway to the 100,000?
Not quite. We're coming up on 41, which is fine because, you know, there's all of these Kickstarter statistics, and statistically 60% of projects that reach 40% of funding succeed. So we're over that 40% tipping point. We still have over a month to go. So I think we're good, but that doesn't mean, you know, people shouldn't go give money, because they should.
They should. Yeah, they absolutely should. And it's steampunk and it's a Western and it's all sorts of perfect things right there.
To be perfectly honest, I think it's going to be awesome.
Where can they find out more information about you?
Well, the easy thing to do is actually to go to our website. If you go to cowboysandenginesofthemovie.com, under the tab for the team, you'll see a page about me. And on that page are links to my IMDb, my Twitter, my Facebook, and my blog and my Wikipedia page. So it's all right there. Start there.
That sounds like a good thing to do. I think everybody should go do that.
I see. We're so of like mind here.
Yeah. And you guys can follow me, of course, at Elizabeth Amber. And, you know, my website is amberonmass.com. So this was Bryn Pryor that you've been listening to for an hour and being delighted by all his fabulous stories.
Or not.
I'm sure they were. And, you know, it'd be great to see, you know, follow up with you after you're doing, you know, done with the actual film and stuff.
Terrific. I would love that.
Okay. All right, guys. Thanks, as always, for listening to Vodka O'Clock. And check out amberonmass.com for more.
Thank you so much.